WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Rosabeth Moss-Cantor is an advocate of humanizing the corporate workplace. She is a management consultant who has worked with many Fortune 500 companies, and she holds an endowed chair as professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. She's written about the corporate world's resistance to change and the problems women and minorities have faced in the system. She's analyzed the innovations which have improved productivity and the quality of life at work. After studying the successes and failures of corporate management in the 70s and 80s, Cantor is now looking ahead to the 90s to see what new challenges await us as America tries to keep competitive while Americans try to balance work with a home life. That's the subject of her new book, When Giants Learn to Dance. Rosabeth Moss-Cantor, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, you point out that the 80s really brought an emphasis on the entrepreneurial spirit within the corporation. That brought many innovations, but you think it also brought certain excesses which we need to be thinking about as we enter the 90s, such as?
Well, one excess inside the company I called cowboy management, that our model of what it took to be successful was performance shootouts, was rugged individualism and intense competition where department fought with other departments in the same company for resources, or divisions all competed with each other, sometimes for the same customers. That's a style that we thought came out of the entrepreneurial spirit, but it's a style that really gets a company in trouble, because instead of intense competition, we really need more collaboration and teamwork. So inside the workplace, too much competition. And outside the workplace, I became concerned that entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial zeal was creating overload for employees. Too much work to do, too many challenges, too many opportunities. And I think opportunity is great, but I also think that we all want to have a private life, too, and not devote every single moment of our waking existence to work.
You interviewed some of the workers at Apple back before the corporate shakeup there, when Apple was really being praised as the company with the most entrepreneurial spirit and excitement on behalf of the workers and everything. But the workers told you a lot of criticisms that they had about the company. Would you share some of those with us?
Sure, because you can have so much entrepreneurship in which anybody is free to start anything or create a project or define their own plan or system, that you might end up with 17 different forecasting systems. That's what they had at Apple, and they used to joke that they had 17 and none of them worked. In short, they had a lot of trouble harnessing all that great spirit to a shared goal. And so people complained that that didn't give them more power. What it did was make it harder to get lots and lots of enthusiasm behind a single idea that might be the right direction. They also did talk about working much too hard. They were working 12, 14 hours a day. Some people were very proud of it because that was saying, gee, we must be very special people. If we can get all of this done, we must be super people. But there were also some concerns about burnout. How long could I keep up that pace?
Okay, so you're critical of some of the entrepreneurial excesses of the 80s. You think that the old style of corporate bureaucracy is kind of becoming obsolete. What are some of the new ideals that you think we should bring with us into the 90s?
Well, I think that we don't want pure bureaucrats. I mean, as we don't want organization man conformists, and I think the male designation did apply, mm-hmm. and we don't want just 9-to-5ers who come in the morning, process a certain amount of paper, and go home. But at the same time, we don't want those cowboys who are too competitive and work too hard. So I think the new model would be the athlete, if we have to have an image of the hero in business. I mean, I thought athletes really ought to be the ideal. First of all, we need leaner corporations to begin with that are faster on their feet, and that's really what I mean by a dancing giant. And we also need the skill and the emphasis on professionalism that an athlete has, coupled with the ability to work on teams and to harness that skill in the service of a shared goal. And the other reason I like the athlete image is that I think we're not only competing these days in the business marketplace inside America, but America is playing in a kind of corporate Olympics against other countries, and we need all the skill of the athlete and all the teamwork of companies working together in order to succeed.
You also say that you think we should have loyalty to ethics and to professionalism, to professional standards, and that should supersede our loyalty to the company.
Yes, absolutely. We have a lot of nostalgia today for corporate loyalty and whatever happened to company loyalty. And I'm not sure that old-fashioned company loyalty was such a good thing, because that did often bring us knee-jerk conformity, and I'll do whatever the boss wants, whether it's the right idea or not, and I'll overlook mistakes, or I'll overlook sometimes product defects or moral shortcomings, because if I blew the whistle on them, then I wouldn't be a loyal corporate soldier. So I'm not sure I like that old kind of loyalty. But it was easier to have it in a world when it looked like your future was guaranteed. You'd go to work for a company after high school, and that company might keep promoting you and do the job, and you'd be in that company doing similar kinds of job for life. Well, that world doesn't exist anymore. First of all, I don't think we can afford the waste. I don't think we can afford the product defects. And also, I don't think it's realistic. I think these days, people's careers are going to be defined by their own professional skills, and that means their own pride in the projects they do and the work they perform, rather than expecting Daddy or Mommy Corporation to take care of me for life.
And you think that security will come from knowing you're employable, as opposed to coming from thinking that the corporation will keep you in this job or promote you within the corporation for the rest of your life?
Yes, employability security might be a better basis for security in the future. It's not knowing that my future is guaranteed based on what I'm doing today, but that if I work hard, if I keep my skills current, if I know how to create something myself, if I can think like an entrepreneur, maybe start a business, or maybe at least know how to take initiative, then that's my best hope of remaining employable. If not for this company, then maybe for another company, or maybe for my own business.
Rosabeth Moss-Cantor is my guest. She is a management consultant and author of the new book, When Giants Learn to Dance. I had to tell you the part of your book that struck me as both funny and scary. And you're talking about how busy people are now and how impossible it's become to balance a work life and a home life. And you ask the question, will busier than thou replace holier than thou as the way Americans show off their importance to one another? And it's the first time I came across the idea of busyness as a sign of status or importance. What made you think about that?
Well, I think it goes on among my own peer group, actually, where everybody pulls out their calendar because there's no time to have lunch together. And then instead of simply saying, well, I can't see you until June 23rd, people say, well, gee, I've got breakfast here and lunch here, and I'm going to be in five different cities. I also saw it at Apple, and I saw it in a lot of startup firms, that people were proud of the fact that they were so important that their calendars were crowded all the time. And I began to think that workaholics were not simply psychologically disturbed individuals that could never let go of work, nor were people working so hard just because the corporation was loading it on them. If you're in a world where you're creating something, or you're in charge, or it's yours to do, that's tremendously exhilarating. And so people want to put more time into work and put their identity into work. And so I did see that kind of showing off about, I'm so important because I run all these important projects.
Did this make you rethink your own schedule?
Well, I've always had to work hard on my own schedule, but one of the proposals that I have in the book actually does come out of my experience of what helps me stay sane in my own life, because I have a husband and I have a 10-year-old son, and I adore them, by the way, and the solution to the work-family problem in America is not simply better childcare, although we need better childcare, but people also want to see their families. I mean, I like to actually spend time with my husband and son. And I realized that I'm able to work very, very hard on projects for a defined period of time if I know it's going to be over and there's a reward that comes at the end, like finishing a book and then it comes out, or marketing a new idea, or even finishing teaching a course, and it's a defined period, it's finished, and when it's over, I know that if I need to, I can take the next month a little easier. I could take long weekends. I could bring my child into the office with me during school vacations. And it was that flexibility over the course of a year that helped me keep sane. And then when I saw that in some companies, the people that seemed to do the best job of balancing work and family had that same kind of rhythm in their lives, a project rhythm. Some weeks, yes, they might be traveling and they might have breakfast meetings and go home late for dinner, but other weeks they had a little more control over their time, and if they wanted to, they could work at home a day a week. And that's not just women, by the way. There's a male executive I know, powerful CEO of a powerful New York company, that whenever the weather gets nice, every Friday, he works at his country house and doesn't come into the office. And everybody knows that. And nobody says, by the way, that he's on a mommy track.
Well, let me ask you about the mommy track. This is on the minds of a lot of people right now. And this was the expression given to an idea that was put forth by Felice Schwartz in a recent article. And the idea is that women are more expensive to maintain in corporations, she says, and that we should divide women into two categories, women with a commitment to career and family, and women who are primarily devoted to the career. She says that women primarily devoted to the career can do quite well rising up the corporate ladder. Women who want to divide their time with their family aren't going to rise as well. You're going to have to worry about child care, pregnancy leaves. This was bad news to a lot of women hearing this theory put across. What do you think of it?
Well, I laughed the first time I read her statement that women cost more, and I would have laughed more if people weren't taking it seriously. I actually thought that that the evidence said women cost less because you could get away with paying them less and they'd work twice as hard to prove themselves. So we start with a ridiculous premise. I don't think that differentiation between women who care about their careers and women who care about their kids makes sense at all. I mean, I see in my own life, I wouldn't even know how to answer that question, which is more important to you, work or family? I mean, I fiercely love everything I do, and I know I'm not alone. I mean, my data, my studies, the things I've seen in corporations show that people are getting very angry at that kind of stereotyping and pigeonholing. And among the people who are getting angry are the men of about 35 or 36 that are starting to have their first kids and are falling in love with them. And are saying, now, wait a second, I want to be home to change the diapers. I mean, when my husband and I used to compete to see which one could change the diapers because we were so in love with our son, I realized there was a new phenomenon going on in the world. So men are parents, too. I'm concerned about the needs of working parents, not just of women. And I'm very concerned about anything that tracks or stereotypes people, because in our rapidly changing world, we need everybody and their skills, and we don't know which skills we're going to need from which department or which level. So how could we possibly say that some people aren't going to get training or some people aren't going to get opportunities? You can see I have a lot to say on this. My parting shot is that I think the assumption behind that argument was an old-fashioned, outmoded assumption that people have a career in a single corporation for life up the corporate ladder. And that's just not true of careers anymore. Most people are going to spend part of their time in business for themselves, part of their time employed by somebody else. Sometimes they'll be a professional independently freelancing. There's just so much more variety in careers today that the idea of rigid tracks simply don't fit what's going on.
I wonder if you think that some people will generalize this into that there should be a mommy track and a daddy track, too, since now men are spending more time with their children. You know, that in other words, that some managers will start dividing the workforce into people with children and people without it, and will look to the single people or the people without children as being the ones who are more potentially productive. Do you think that is happening, and what do you think?
Well, since such a high proportion of the workforce has children, mm-hmm. I don't know who they'd be talking about. First of all, any manager that did that would probably be hurting himself or herself as well, because there aren't enough single people to staff all the important jobs we need. So I could see that people might try to use that to discriminate, because stereotyping still does go on, and if we give people a license to discriminate, then they'll do it, but they'd be making a big mistake. In fact, anybody who's sensible about work will often realize that sometimes it's the busiest people to whom you give projects, because it's the busiest people who know how to get things done. And they can be busy for lots of reasons. Some of it's because they have kids, some of it's because they don't. Also, of course, kids make more demands on people at different times in their life. That's not a situation that goes on forever. If people on the average today are in the workforce for 35 or 40 years or more in some cases, then the slice of time when they've got young children is such a small slice of life that to make corporate policy around that small slice of life would be ridiculous.
Do you think that the men now who are becoming fathers and who really want to be able to spend some time as fathers at home with their family can be a real help to women so that women aren't discriminated against for being mothers?
Oh, sure.
Do you see that kind of teamwork happening?
In some places where there are more enlightened people, it isn't so much the idea of spending time at home with the children during the work week. Although, as I said, I see male executives spending time at home during the work week because they like to work at home. I think there will be more work at home, and that will be more legitimate. And nobody has to know when you're talking on the telephone or sitting at your computer screen holding a computer conference. Nobody has to know whether what's in the corner is your photography equipment because you're a male photography buff, or whether what's in the corner is your kid in a playpen. So I think that's going to give more freedom, and I think men like that flexibility in their lives too. But I saw something fascinating recently. It didn't happen to come from an American executive, but it was a sign of the times. It was a Swedish CEO who's the CEO of a major company in Sweden. He was needing to create more teamwork in his company, a sense of shared values and so forth. So he decided to take his 40 top managers off to a resort for a week or so. And he decided that he wanted them to bring their families, their spouses, and their children with them because he has a young child. He has two young children, as a matter of fact, and he didn't want to leave them for that period of time, and he realized how important his family was to him. And he said, if I really want spirit and solidarity and teamwork in this company, the families have to be a part of it. And I was really happy about that. I got invited to come as a speaker, and I was told, bring my husband and son. And they got to know the families of this Swedish company. And I thought, what a great role model this is. So it's not simply that you spend time at home with your kids. It's also that I think we have to incorporate the reality of people's families back into the workplace. Why shouldn't kids be able to come and see their parents at work, for example? That's not a disruption. Once in a while it is, I suppose, if you had a lot of toddlers running around the office screaming. Mostly it's a pleasure for people, and boy does it help with that sense of overload. Suddenly even unmanageable tasks seem more manageable.
You've been throughout your work as a management consultant looking at how women have been faring in the corporate world. How has what has been happening to women's careers compare with what you thought was going to happen back in, say, 1977 when you were writing about the subject a lot? You know, have women risen as rapidly as you thought that they were going to?
As rapidly? Well, I kept hoping that the rise would be very, very rapid, but that was a hope. In terms of reality, I felt that it would take a critical mass of women with the right credentials and the right track record who couldn't be dismissed as tokens, who couldn't be dismissed as unusual. And it's only been in recent years that we've started to have that critical mass. I mean, many of the women who were once touted as potential CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, I remember all those lists 10 years ago, many of them were close friends of mine, and so I know what's happened to them. In many cases, they were put in positions where their credentials were maybe okay, but they didn't quite have the experience, but they got an incredible amount of publicity because they were the first division manager in Company X. And because of that, all attention was on them, and if they so much as stumbled, it made headlines. And that spotlight was often very rough on them, and many of those women have gone off to do other things. They've had pauses in their career. They've gone off, for example, to work in consulting firms or search firms or investment firms where they were a partner rather than the CEO. I'm noticing that many of them are going back in now at fairly high levels because they have accumulated more experience. But my hope is the next generation. It's the women who have MBAs, who really understand the business world, who are in their 30s. They are very ambitious. They are beginning to master the work-family dilemmas. They're climbing to good positions. The men around them respect them for what they know and what they can bring. I'm very hopeful about what they'll bring us. A lot of them are also willing to leave to start their own businesses, and I think that's a good route, by the way, because if you can prove that you can lead your own company, you can create something or invent something, and you can run it for profit and do very well, I think that generation of women entrepreneurs are going to look very attractive to the big corporations and watch the big companies start buying up those small companies to get the women leaders.
You've been consulting to corporations for many years now. Were men at the top initially a little reluctant to take advice from you?
Oh, I came with so many credentials. In fact, recently somebody introduced me and read my bio and said I have 10 honorary doctorates. So I got up to the podium and just for fun I said, and you can call me Dr. Cantor. Well, that was a joke, but in fact having the credentials and being able to be called doctor made a big difference. And I was often got entree despite the fact that I was a woman. It's because somebody had heard me or read about me or read one of the things I had written, and so that was a help. But it has been, when I go off on the corporate retreat with the top executives, I used to laugh and call it me and the boys in Florida. I mean, it is. I am often the only woman there, except for the travel arranger, and that I think is scandalous. In fact, it's led me sometimes to have a little fun with it. I was with one company, there were 200 people in the audience, 4 women and 196 men, and it was a large oil company, and they were a pretty progressive company, and the people at the top seemed to have a good sense of humor. So when I finished, and I was giving them a very serious talk about innovation and product development and new technology, but I couldn't resist. When I finished, I said, thank you for being such good hosts and ensuring that everything went smoothly and making sure that there wouldn't be a crowd in the ladies' room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, when I said that, the 4 women in the audience all stood up and cheered. And I think the best we can do with this situation is make jokes about it and make it clear that we're easy to get along with. You know, women can be fun to have in your organization.
Now, I've noticed that you and many other management consultants don't and never have worked in large corporations yourselves.
Well, Harvard University might count as a large corporation. In fact, Harvard probably in budget terms and endowment terms is every bit as big as the Fortune 500. But it's true that many of us who have been both critics and challengers and helpers of the corporation have needed to be from outside, and I'll tell you why. It's because the corporation had been a closed world, listening only to itself, particularly in the 50s and 60s, and what it really needed was refreshing voices from outside. In some cases, I was the first outside speaker that some large corporations had ever brought into their in-house seminars that were held on the premises, and I found that quite striking, that they really had been closed to outside influences. And when that happens, the people who are inside kind of lose perspective, and they need somebody who has a broad view rather than has been socialized into the corporate world to come and help them. And so a lot of companies do deliberately now seek people from different industries or from outside of their business, because that's the way they think they'll get a fresh look and they'll shake up their thinking a little bit.
Before you started consulting to corporations, you were writing about communes. You traveled around the country studying communes. You wrote about it. Is there a connection between communes and corporations for you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, thank you for reminding me of the 1960s. That, in some ways, I miss it because it was so colorful and expressive and exuberant. What I was really studying was commitment, motivation, the building of community. In fact, some people have said, going back to those early writings of mine that actually first appeared in the early 1970s, they've said that I was one of the first writers about corporate culture, because what I was looking at was how strong communities create that feeling of teamwork and solidarity. So that's one thread. The other interesting thread is that many of the people who were the entrepreneurs of the 60s were doing it through alternative organizations of various kinds. And in fact, even Apple Computer really was started by kids who were hippies. It was named Apple because Steve Jobs felt that was his favorite fruit. He was a health food nut. And it's some of the spirit of the 60s and 70s of that youth movement that in fact is infecting the corporation now. And it's those people, it's my generation. I mean, I'm now in my middle 40s, and we're the ones who are climbing to the responsible positions. But we're bringing with us, I think, a different kind of spirit, a view that work should be fun, a view that teamwork makes sense, and that we should be more egalitarian. A lot of the most successful companies today are giving up the big corner office, for example, in favor of a much more democratic, egalitarian workplace. And I think a lot of that's the values of the 60s. And what I brought out of all of those studies was how you do create a better world where people care about their work and feel a sense of mission with each other.
Did you have to wear a business suit when you were visiting communes, or did you end up wearing jeans when you started consulting the corporations?
Oh, that's funny. Well, no, just the opposite, Terry. I wish I could say something colorful about that. But I've always been interested in the leading edge of change, the most innovative things going on in the society. And for a while, a lot of the innovation in the 60s and 70s was coming from those alternative movements. Now, I think where the action is in business. I think a lot of the experimentation and the innovation is coming out of the business world, and it's very exciting. We're still wearing business suits, though. I'm today dressed in a navy blue suit with a blue Oxford cloth blouse.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.